If you've never heard me say it before, I'll say it right now. Your ranch is not a cottage, and it never will be. These are two different types of houses, right down to their bones, to the floor plan, that is, and right up to every little detail that makes each of these different types of houses great. I'm not here to tell you that a cottage isn't a lovely house, and the modern cottage style isn't the wrong type of remodel for a cottage, but it's never going to fit properly with a mid-century home. So today I actually want to sidetrack myself and talk about the cottage style in America generally. I'll tell you about my favorite subcategory of cottage, the bungalow, and why I love it, and give a brief history of the modern cottage movement. But at the end of the day, I'm hoping that will be obvious to you how these different, perfectly valid styles of homes are not mid-century or modern homes, and why you don't want to use the modern cottage playbook on your mid-mod remodel. Hey there, welcome back to Mid-Mod Remodel. This is the show about updating MCM homes, helping you match a mid-century home to your modern life and not turn it into a cottage. I'm your host, Della Hansman, architect and mid-century ranch enthusiast, and you're listening to episode 1610. Before we get into it, the best way I know to keep your ranch remodel mid-century, to avoid that tractor beam pull of cottage court design that's always trying to creep in around the edges, especially when you, like me, are trying to plan a budget-friendly remodel, it's to focus on the cornerstones of good mid-mod design. Now, I've done an entire podcast series on this. That was back in December. But you can grab a quick guide to the concept of the cornerstones of mid-century design in a PDF at midmod-midwest.com/cornerstones. I'll walk you through how to deploy playful asymmetry with balanced designs, the simple shapes, the trim profiles, the door types, roof lines, and decorative details that define a mid-mod house, the material palette that makes up the aesthetic of mid-century, and as a bonus, how to plan great flow between the spaces, both inside your house and between in and out. You can find the link to that in the show notes today as well, and the transcript and more, and some cool sketches of cottages and also of mid-century ranches at midmod-midwest.com/1610. So the term cottage has been around for a long time, and it has had many varied meanings in the US and in Europe. Going back to a word origin level, a cottage was once just the house of a cottager or a cotter, who was a person who performed some type of full-time work for a feudal lord and was granted in return the tenant or free right to live in a small freestanding home with a garden just large enough to feed their family. Later, the word came to mean a small freestanding rural home, which is why we also have them in America. No feudal lords here and no cotters. But I don't really think of the early American housing types that they can fit under the label cottage, but they have other specific definitions, the log cabin, the salt box, the Federalist home, the Cape Cod. But cottage style as a choice, as a design preference, came into vogue, to my mind, in the early part of the 1900s. The craftsman cottage of the early teens was a California offshoot of the arts and crafts movement happening in Europe, and then spawned a bunch of variations across the country. The type of cottage that appeals to me most, probably because it's the variation closest to a ranch, is the bungalow. And in the context of American housing typologies, a bungalow has a pretty specific meaning because a lot of them were built in rapid succession with very consistent features over a short period of time. And if that sounds familiar, well, the same is true at a slightly later period for ranch houses. There are some reasons behind that. A housing crisis, building boom, the glories of newly developed suburban living, and just generally this thing we were dealing with in the first part of the 20th century, the new idea of a servantless single-family home being where most people lived. Now, I'd like to talk to you about the Chicago bungalow as a type of cottage because it's the one I know and love best. In my time in Chicago, I got to study this, and a bungalow is in some ways very similar to a ranch. I know, I just said cottages and mid-century homes are never the same, but there are some similarities between the Chicago bungalow and the early Midwestern tract ranch. They each share an older California cousin, which had more variation, more drama, and was originally designed as a one-off by architects, and then they were sort of boiled down into a working-class variety that was built not as tracts, not by one developer in a huge area, but over and over and over again in a small area in a small amount of time. So let's look at the differences and similarities between a Chicago bungalow and a ranch. There is actually an area around Chicago that's known as the Bungalow Belt, and it's basically the outer rim, at that time, the outer belt of suburban development. The belt bungalows were not tract housing in the way that mid-century houses in the Midwest often are. They're not the product of one developer who bought a field and then filled it up with houses that they built themselves and then sold them off onto individual buyers. They were often built, sometimes several lots or even several blocks at a time, by builders who wanted to profit on this population boom that was going on in Chicago in the 1930s. They were more or less mass-produced from basic plans and using the same stock of local building materials, so they look very similar. And the Chicago Bungalow Belt type has a similar footprint to a modest early Midwestern ranch home, but a couple of significant differences. They both do have a basement, which was originally left unfinished, and most of which have later been turned into living space. And they typically are raised slightly. So the main floor, the main plan level, is above the grade. So you don't walk straight out as in a California house. You walk straight out from the floor level onto a patio. And in a mid-century house and in the Midwest, and also in a bungalow in the Midwest, you usually step down several levels. And that's because the frost footing of 3 feet in Chicago, or more like 4 and 5 feet as you go further north from Chicago in the Midwest, requires that you might as well dig down far enough to put in a basement. And once you've put in a basement, you don't need to dig down any farther. So you might as well let the main floor of the house stick up above grade a little bit to save yourself on excavation. Some of these things did not change with time. But while these two buildings are very closely related, they are not the same. You can look at the two floor plans, and I actually have a fun side-by-side comparison of the two floor plans. They each have the same set of rooms, an entry that goes into a living room, a living dining room combined, and a kitchen space that's separated from it slightly, plus 2 or 3 bedrooms and a single bathroom in the original build style. The arrangement of the room is subtly distinct. In the typical 3-bedroom Chicago bungalow, you always enter through the small vestibule or porch that's on one side of the front of the house, and then you pass through that into a parlor that stretches most of the house width across the front. Adjacent but separate will be a dining room, and beyond that lies the kitchen. The kitchen is always separated from the dining area significantly, not just by a wall, but usually by a built-in hutch, a pantry, or even the stairs are sometimes placed there, going down to the basement and or up to an attic. The idea was to keep the sight, smell, and the heat of the cooking process distinctly away from the rest of the house and out of the public eye. From the kitchen, there's usually a connection out to the backyard and garage. And then on the other side, running parallel to those living spaces, you have a bedroom, bathroom, and bedroom, usually separated with their own tiny access hallway. Occasionally, a 3-bedroom house would locate 2 bedrooms across the back of the house, but in that case, the kitchen would still have a side door, a separate access that would go out towards the back of the house. Now, a ranch, especially an early Midwestern ranch, has the same set of rooms, a living dining room that you enter into, a kitchen, and the bedroom and bath separated, but it flows very differently. The foyer, the entry space of a ranch, is dissolved in a mid-century house. It's often separated only by a column, a knee wall, or a difference in the flooring. The living and dining rooms will be one shared space, and the kitchen, while theoretically open plan in the California version, is probably its own room, but it's only separated by a wall, usually with a doorless open doorway from the living spaces. And the bedrooms will be typically side by side across the short end of the house with a bath between or beside them. The thing is, when you talk about the floor plans of these, and if you glance at the show notes page, you might find this interesting. You can't actually compare these two floor plans side by side, because the other thing that dramatically changed in America in housing context between the era of the bungalows in the 1930s and the era of the ranches in the 1950s was the way we thought about suburban development at all. Changes in lifestyle and land usage, plus the growth of single family car ownership between the 20s and the 50s meant that the buildings changed, and so did their lots. So the ranches are oriented with their long side facing the street on a much wider but sometimes less deep lot. But the bungalows were oriented long side to the others. So they were stacked like cigarettes in a row. And I don't know why I just went to cigarette in my head, but stacked densely. And their short end was front to the street and back to an alley. In Chicago, there's always an alley. And again, for their times, You could describe the bungalow and the ranch as similar in style because they both had the most basic, acceptable, low level of trim, detailing, and general decor. But in the bungalow, although at its time it was considered to be a very plain, basic, under-detailed home, it still had a whole bunch of details of trim, of built-in cabinets, of stained glass, leaded glass windows, of glass panels in the built-ins. And there's just a higher level of detailing. As we come into the mid-century era, that style is not even so much that it is more minimalist, but that it is more simple. By the time we go from the 1930s, the bungalow era, to the 1950s, the ranch era, it's not that people were missing gingerbread trim and six-panel doors. They were reveling in the easy maintenance and the low cleaning necessity and the new technology. The hallmark of a ranch was always its array of modern cooking and washing appliances, not the details. Okay, so that's the bungalow versus the ranch. But if we come back, every other type of cottage has more variety than the Chicago bungalow belt. And its uniqueness was one of the selling points, even when it was being mass-produced. For example, you could buy a Sears catalog house. Did you know you could buy houses from the Sears catalog back in the day? You could. And they would ship you the entire kit with operating instructions, and you'd put it up yourself on site. My mother's parents actually assembled a house, not following the instructions, because in my family, we do not follow the instructions, but they bought two garage kits from a Sears catalog and used the pieces to put together into a very wonky shaped, very modest, not quite ranch style house in my grandmother's hometown in Monticello, Illinois. I've seen it and it's odd, but let's not get too distracted. The kit houses that were described as cottages you could get from Sears would still have vernacular style details that were meant to be very charming and ad hoc. They would have little gabled entrances or little arched curvature or faux Tudor or English Revival or American Southwest detailing. So you can see a lot of varieties, peaked roofs, slow sloped ceilings, but everything in that form of cottage is, if not ornate, at least cute. It's twee. It's charming. And I don't know how it would have read to the people back then. It might have read as minimalist and simple in a world where we didn't have mass-produced materials. But to us today, it's always going to feel like the highest form of cottage is one that's ornate. It's decorated with an arched doorway between each of the main rooms, with exaggerated peak roofs, with stonework or stained glass windows, wood trim that's kind of elaborate, decorated woodwork and storage built in every possible place, built-in bookshelves. All right, so I've listed a bunch of similarities and differences between the original cottages and the original mid-century ranch houses. But we're talking about remodels. So we're talking about modern mid-century and we're talking about modern cottage. So let's give a little history of modern cottage style. And I feel like it's been kind of haunting me my whole life and not in a good way. In the 80s, it showed up in Laura Ashley interiors. And then in my teens, it turned into the sort of shabby chic era of faux distressed furniture, rag and sponge painted walls. And then it was still hearkening back to that same ethos of faux vernacular, if not actual vernacular, rustic, cute, twee. And then we get the Pottery Barn version in the early 2000s, which sort of rolled along quietly in the background as a baseline taste until the moment that the sun broke the clouds, or if you view this as a negative thing, everything came crashing down when Chip and Joanna Gaines kicked off modern farmhouse style, which I class as a variation on modern cottage, with their show in 2013. And from there, it sort of evolved into what we see today. I'm not an expert in the style details of modern cottage because I avoid it like the plague, but there are a few common themes. And it certainly means painting everything except a few wooden accents plaster white, decorating with raw linen slip-covered furniture, a color theme of leather, tan, beige, off-white, neutrals. Judging from the images that came up with a quick Google search, we might be back to rag painting and sponge painting the walls again. Why? Why are the 90s back? I don't want to wear stonewashed jeans with wide legs anymore. But it's that same nostalgia. The same nostalgia that's bringing back the stonewashed jeans is bringing back this resurgence in modern cottage style. Now, weirdly though, while actual cottages and the Laura Ashley gingham print style of the 80s that we're kind of going back to in our minds are always cozy, the most modern version of the modern cottage actually feels the opposite of cozy. It's this very harsh combination of all white surfaces except a few shiny black metal accents at the window and door trim. And it seems to look a little haunted in most of the houses that I find it. Now, there are things we can learn from cottage style. By all means, we can borrow some ideas from their space planning because cottages are also often small footprints like mid-century homes. They can be very cozy, and we can think about furniture layouts or kitchen space planning even. The footprint, the floor plan, can always be borrowed from one to another where applicable. But we do not need to follow their aesthetic, nor should we. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with the style decision to go cottage. It can very well be applied to any cottage. Or I would argue you can apply cottage style to any house built in the 80s, the 90s, or the last 24 years that lacks any other inbuilt sense of style. My general feeling is if you love the look of a cottage, if cottage is what draws you, find an area of urban or suburban development, largely developed in the 1930s or before, or the 80s and after, and go nuts. Add the details that the previous remodel stripped and removed, or never had. But because, I mean, going back, the same kind of mistakes have been made in those homes, in those kitchens, those bathroom updates that have been made in mid-century homes. The 80s were just as likely to put a Victorian kitchen with heavy oak woodwork into a cottage as they were to put in the simple, bright, painted cabinets and glass front doors that would have been more appropriate. Similarly, if someone got to it in 1990, they might have tried to create a little slice of Tuscany in their bathroom, which would not have worked any more than it would in a mid-century house. But you're here listening to this podcast because you live in a mid-century house and you love it. So we're fighting the same fight as the cottage owners in a different way. We're trying to keep some line of connection. Again, not to live in a museum necessarily, not to turn the clock back on your build date, but for a successful remodel, a timeless one, one that will really last, you do want to make choices that feel aligned with the style DNA of your house. Your goal is to make choices for your home that will feel like it's the cool young cousin of what it might originally have been. I encourage you, wherever you can, to avoid the advice, the Home Depot standards, the what we're going to see in a lot of the shelter magazines and most of HGTV that says the one style update, the current style update, all you should do as an update is to apply cottage style detailing to your home. The beadboard, the leaded glass windows, the overly constructed trim, the six panel doors. All of that is great, but not for us. So when you are looking into how to make great choices for your house, remember your mid-century style guide. You can always come back to your style guide. And if you have any questions on how to make that happen, I've got a free resource and style guides for you too. That's at midmod-midwest.com/style guide. But I just want you to remember that there is a difference between a cottage style and a ranch style. And if you'd like to have a look at that, I really do encourage you to go take a gander at the comparison sketches that I have between that classic, the most mid-century-ish house type there is that falls within the cottage umbrella is the Chicago bungalow. And it's still, it's so clearly not a ranch, not a mid-century home. All right, today's pep talk, this week's pep talk, comes by way of our recently started Mid-Mod Remod Squad. For those of you who don't know, this is when we have a group of new Ready to Remodel students all join the Ready to Remodel program at once, often after a live masterclass like we just had, and I schedule some bonus calls above and beyond our regular first Monday of the month office hours call so we can keep our enthusiasm high, get to know each other, have a sense of group camaraderie. It's so much fun. So as a result of kicking off a new Mid-Mod Remod Squad, I've been thinking a lot about what it takes to break the inertia, to get moving, to feel like you've made progress on planning a remodel when you've spent so long thinking you need to get started, but you haven't. And one thing I'm finding is that there are so many commonalities between everyone, no matter their different circumstances, who've all joined at this moment. And as they get into that energy of, I've broken the inertia, I've started to plan, they've all kind of jumped in different but overall similar ways to an endpoint question. To boil it down, it's people just sort of getting to the nitty-gritty details before they have done the internal work to figure out how they'll answer those nitty-gritty details and wanting to have the answer before they have properly framed the question. It's so easy to do this. We all get to We think we're planning a remodel, so our brain goes to the final, to the purchasing decisions, or the layout, feet and inches, or the structural challenges. And yet, actually, the most important foundational thing is the dream phase. Now, a dream, properly doing your dream phase, won't make your house magically bigger, but it will help you march confidently up to your more specific problems later, when you've done those first steps first, and see the answer in a new way. Now, I have the entire master plan laid out, helpfully, step by step, in workbooks and classes inside the program. But what really helps people on these calls, more than me telling them you're getting ahead of yourself and this will all become clear when we follow the process, is to see everyone else having some variation of the same stressors that they're having. It's so validating. So today's pep talk is really me singing a refrain of my favorite song, which is, go find your people. Find the other people who care about mid-century choices and who are somewhere in the process of an active remodel plan right now. Because those people are going to understand you, they're going to sympathize with you, they're going to support you, they're going to reinforce you and help you make great choices. Even more than your nearest and dearest. People who love you and care about you, but don't love and care about your remodel as much as you do. You don't have to join my mid-mod remod squad. You can go find your own. Make friends with someone in your neighborhood who's also remodeling. Create a meetup group. Find people on Instagram and DM them to ask how their plans are going. If you can commiserate about the tricky parts of your plan with theirs. But what you need, wherever you go, is to find someone else who's sharing this common sense of a remodel plan. And when you see them jumping ahead to the end point, and then your instinct is to tell them, hey, let's go back to the beginning and frame the question properly, you'll catch yourself doing the same thing, and it will all feel so much more possible and easy. This is how we make all the hard things seem easier. The secret is to follow the process from dream at the start all the way through to the end of the master plan method. But don't go it alone. Go find your team. Go find your people. It will make it easier. Okay, here's this week's quick fix or level one update for your mid-century home. Raise your hand if you work from home. Now, even if you don't, you may still have a space in your house that is designated as an office space or a get work done. Choosing to go full vintage decor in your work area is a personal decision everyone has to make for themselves. Those center of the room double-sided vintage desks are a delight to my eye and a very inefficient space of my small home office. I'm much more likely to talk to someone on Zoom than in person, so I have a practical stand-up sit-down desk that is not mid-century at all. You need to make your own choice in this way. Ergonomics has to play into your decision making. So as you adjust your setup or create from scratch a mid-century style home office, you need to think about what is going to avoid repetitive stress injuries. Think about the proper height of desk, chair, monitor, table, etc. These days, like I say, I don't mess around with it. But there is one obvious choice you can make in an office that will satisfy your mid-century style eye and not create any injury to your back or risks, and that is storage shelving. I've gone slightly practical over full mid-century in my choice. I've got a 70s era Ivar IKEA set of wood shelves. They're modest, but please me, and they fit with their pine boards and their simple shapes into the ethos of the mid-century era. But a little more effort and a little more floor space could be achieved with a wall-mounted set of shelves. And these can go super high-end with a gorgeous custom teak vintage combination of bookshelves, magazine display shelves, writing desk, closed box storage, and more. If you ever find these listed on Facebook Marketplace for any reason, for a reasonable price, run, do not walk to your car and buy them immediately. You can also sometimes find these in higher end mid-century antique shops. There's one that's been on the wall at the back of Atomic Antiques for over a year now, and it's not cheap, but I want someone to bring this into their home for themselves. There are, however, much more affordable DIYable options. All you really need is a set of pine boards and some of those basic wall-mounted brackets and the little brass adjustable bracket strips you can find in any container store. You could even do them in white for a slightly less authentically mid-century look. A little more searching, like I say, will turn them up for a brown metal or a black finish. There's also a company, Modern Shelving, that will help you to put together a semi-custom system. And these are, in the end, not just appropriate for offices, but also for bedrooms, for living rooms, if you want to surround a TV in a graceful way on a wall. Remember, you don't have to fill those shelves with stuff. Mid-century decor often left a lot of negative space, that is, open areas, to display a few art objects that could be switched out for seasonal decor, or store a music system, maybe a smart speaker that would have made your mid-century grandparents green with envy, or framed photos. Remember that the watchword of mid-century design is asymmetry. Don't be tempted to frame in something regular or rectilinear when you don't have to. So think about drawing some strong diagonals with object placement or shelf lengths. And think about offsetting the balance so that a few larger, heavier pieces stretch out longer than others and you have an eye-pleasing, off-centered arrangement on the wall in front of you or behind you to form a nice zoom background. For more on the benefits of asymmetry and how to deploy it in your mid-century house, make sure you check out that podcast episode from last December. That would be episode 1501. All right. Let me know how this goes for you. Find the transcript of this episode and a link to the resources I mentioned, those sketches of the bungalow and the ranch side by side with a side by side floor plan comparison of a bungalow and ranch at the show notes page, midmod-midwest.com/1610. One more thing before I go. I haven't really talked about one of the biggest modern cottage design moves, and in my opinion, one of the biggest mistakes you can make on a mid-century house, which is to paint everything white. And the reason I haven't really addressed that today is that that is such a big topic for me. It's so important. I have so many things to say about it that I'm going to break it out into a separate episode and talk about it next time. So stay tuned for next week when I talk about why white paint is great in moderation, but why you're going to want to avoid it in several key places, and how if you're feeling the urge or being urged by some outside advice giver for reasons to paint something or a lot of things white, I'll talk to you about what other design moves to try first before you go to covering your original walls, woodwork, brick, stone, etc. with thick white paint that you will never be able to as easily or at all take back off. So stay tuned for next week. See you then.